Let us say that after Raghavan starts speaking, everybody except his speaker should be on mute unless you are asking questions. That way we won't have problems of transmission. Okay, so it's very nice today that we have Raghavan Goro from Perimeter Institute, and he's going to tell us about the 1/N expansion in colored tensor models. Raghavan?
Hi everyone. So thank you for inviting me to the ILPGS. So please let me know if I need to speak louder or anything to hear better. So let's go to the table of contents slide, which is the next slide. So my talk today will be divided in three parts. First, I start by an introduction, recalling matrix models. And then I'll go to the core of the talk, discussing the color tensor models. I'll discuss their graphs. Then I'll go and present the 1/N expansion. And after that, I will need to introduce some topological notions in order to conclude that the leading order graphs in these expansions are spheres. And finally, I'll present some conclusions. So let's start. Let's go to slide 3. The fundamental reason to look at such models, as matrix models and tensor models, is the puzzle of space-time and scale. So space-time is one of the most fundamental notions in physics, and more often than not, it appears as a fixed background. And such a background allows us to talk about scale in terms of distances. So we have small distances, which in fundamental physics happens at small distances, at short distances, and this leads to effective physics at large distances. So these scales, they give us a notion of causality going from fundamental to effective physics. However, in general relativity, the metric, so the background itself, it becomes a dynamical variable, so the length scales become dynamical, so they are inadapted to separating fundamental from effective physics. Hence, in this line of thought, two questions arise. Is it possible to define background-independent scales, which don't depend on any kind of distance notion? And second, supposing that we have such a theory of background-independent scales, is it possible to obtain space-time as an effective phenomenon? So let's go to the next slide. Indeed, there exists at least one success story, matrix models in two dimensions. So matrix models, they are a theory in which we have a natural notion of scales and which reproduce some kind of space-time in a certain regime. So in detail, what are matrix models? They are an ab initio combinatorial theory encoded in a path integral. They have built-in scales in the form of a large parameter n, which is the dimension of the matrix. So this is a large number, natural number. And these matrix models, they generate Ribbon graphs, and the Ribbon graphs are associated to surfaces. So all these statements will become clear later in the introduction. Furthermore, the matrix models, they undergo a phase transition, so a condensation, if you want, to a continuum theory. So in a certain regime, the behavior of these models is dominated by large surfaces. Now, matrix models, they are one of the most versatile tools in modern theoretical physics. They've been used in physics in quantum gravity in two dimensions. They've been used for the study of critical phenomena, conformal field theory, and so on and so forth. In mathematics, they've been used for knot theory, number theory, and many other problems. Now, the crux of the versatility of matrix models relies in their 1/N expansion. Indeed, what happens is that this large n parameter gives us a small parameter, 1/N, which allows us to access the behavior of these models in an alternative way and not through a small coupling constant expansion. So in this 1/N expansion, we have access to the behavior of these models in via a different route. And turns out that this different route is more controllable and allows us to understand them much better than the small coupling expansion. So in detail, what a matrix model is, let's go to slide 5. So a matrix model, as I said, is defined by a partition function, which I wrote on the first line there. So you see that this partition function, it has two parts. It has a quadratic part and an interacting part. The interacting part is in blue. So it consists of a trivalent vertex. I have three field insertions. Every field is a matrix with two indices. So such a trivalent vertex is represented on the in the drawing on the left as the blue ribbon vertex. So it is trivalent because the interaction is trivalent. Why is it a ribbon vertex? Well, because each of the discrete indices of the matrix, in fact, is represented by a strand in the drawing. So for instance, I have a strand with associated index A1 on top of my vertex, which is common to the fields phi of A3, A1, and phi A1, A2. So that strand there has an associated discrete index A1, and the other two strands in the drawing, they have an associated index A2, respectively A3. So when I expand this partition function in graph. Every vertex will give me a ribbon vertex, and now I will connect these vertices via lines, which are given by the quadratic part of my partition function. And what is this quadratic part? Well, you see that actually I took here a simple example where the quadratic part just conserves the discrete indices. So it identifies an index, a discrete index A1 on a strand with an index B1 on a strand of a different vertex, and it identifies an index A2 with an index B2. So one should not imagine that every field theory of a field with two variables is a matrix model. Indeed, one needs first to have two variables in order to have ribbon vertices, and it means that the quadratic part conserves the indices in order to generate these ribbon lines which connect the vertices.
In your notation, you've got phi as a field, but the partition function depends on Q. What is Q?
So that's a misnomer. So actually, I wanted to put a small lambda there. So instead of Q, you should read small lambda. So this the partition function depends on the coupling constant small lambda. Is it okay?
Yes.
Okay. Now, in this ribbon graph, so we have vertices, the ribbon vertices, we have the ribbon lines, we have an extra notion. A ribbon graph comes with an extra notion, the notion of a face. So what is a face? It is a closed strand. So I draw a graph with many, many vertices connected by ribbon lines, and I start following a strand, and I follow it till it closes. And I call this object, the closed strand, I call it a face. So the ribbon graph, they have extra structure, vertices, lines, and faces. Now, with this in mind, we see that the partition function evaluates as a sum of a ribbon Feynman graph. So I can just apply the Feynman rule, expand this action, this partition function in graph. How about the amplitude? So the amplitude of a graph, we compute it as follows. You see that every small vertex will pick a small lambda, but also a large n. N, which is factored in front of the action, is the large parameter, the dimension of my matrix. So every vertex will contribute a small lambda times capital N. Now every line, because it's a quadratic integral, will contribute a 1 over n in the amplitude of a graph. So if we go to the next slide, we see that the amplitude of a graph will evaluate in the following way. I get a small coupling constant to the power of the number of vertices, which is the curly n. Don't mistake it for the capital N, which is the large dimension. So I get the coupling constant in front. Then I get the large n to the power minus the number of lines plus the number of vertices, and then a remainder, which is a sum over all the discrete indices, a product over all lines of conservation Kronecker deltas coming from the quadratic part. So our purpose now is to evaluate this remaining sum over product over lines and so on and so forth. So the way to do it is the following. We will group together all the Kronecker deltas which have the same argument. So consider first the Kronecker delta from A1 to B1 associated to the strand, the horizontal strand on the drawing on the left, which goes from the index A1 to B1 on the line there. You see on the horizontal blue strand. Now this index B1 appears in another Kronecker delta, which is associated to the strand going from B1 to its successor, which let's say is called C1, and so on and so forth. So I see that these Kronecker deltas, they compose along faces up to the last Kronecker delta of a face, which is the one going from the last discrete index W1 to the index A1. So all these deltas, they have in common arguments A1, B1, and so on and so forth, and they are the only one which involves them. So I can take them apart and sum them independently. So I see that the intermediate indices like B1, they all sum to 1. And what I remain with is a final sum over only one Kronecker delta from A1 to A1, which is just a free sum. So this big sum will sum over all the indices of the matrix with weight 1. So it will give me another large n factor. So all in all, the amplitude of my graph will be the following. I'll have the coupling constant to the power of the number of vertices times this large n to the alternated sum number of vertices minus the number of lines plus the number of faces. So this alternated sum, it's equals 2 minus 2g, where g is the genus of a graph. So g is a number. I can compute it starting from my graph, obviously. And the important property of this genus is that it's a positive number. So this evaluation of the amplitude of a graph includes the 1 over n expansion. Why is this? It's because as the genus is a positive number, the amplitude is at most n squared. And this corresponds to what we call planar graph of genus 0. and then higher genus graphs are suppressed in 1 over n. Now note that this expansion, as I said, it's an alternative expansion with respect to the small coupling, because the small coupling in front, it has to do with the number of vertices and doesn't see at all the scaling in large n. So if I classify my graphs in terms of their amplitude, I get the first family of graphs, which are the planar graphs, and then I get the genus 1 graphs, which are smaller, and the genus 2 graphs, which are smaller, and so on and so forth. So up till now, I talked about Dibbon graphs and their genus. What's the connection with discretized surfaces? Let's go to slide number 7. So in order to understand the connection between a Dibbon graph and the discretized surface, what we do, we take a graph, and we place a point in the middle of each face, and we draw a red line crossing every Dibbon line. Last, around any Dibbon vertex, we'll get three red lines which form a triangle. So a Dibbon graph, it unambiguously encodes the grouping of triangles, hence the discrete surface. Moreover, the genus of the graph turns out to equal the genus of the surface. The matrix models, what do they do? They sum over all graphs, so they sum over all discretized surfaces with canonical weights, which are dictated by the Feynman rule. So the weights, they come in two places, first combinatorial weights, and second the amplitudes, and we evaluate the amplitudes to see that they have to do with the genus. Now, moreover, in this 1 over n expansion of matrix models, the dominant graphs are the planar ones, which represent the sphere. As I said, the genus of the graph is the genus of the dual surface. So this is how the 1 over n expansion works for matrix models, and the purpose of the rest of this talk is to see how this concept is generalized in higher dimensions. So let's go to slide number 8.
Raghavan, just before that. So yes. can you tell us why the genus of the surface is the same as the genus of graph? Are we doing some surgery to the surfaces or what?
No, so the thing is the following is that if you see the genus of the graph is the number of vertices of the graph minus the number of lines plus the number of faces of the graph. Now if you look in this drawing on page 7, you see that the number of faces of a graph, each face will have a red point in the middle, so it will equate the number of points in the dual grouping of triangles. The number of edges of lines of the graph will equal the number of lines in the dual grouping of triangles, because you see the red lines, for every ribbon line I get a red line. And then finally the number of vertices of the ribbon graph equals the number of triangles. So the alternative sum of vertices minus lines plus faces of the graph equals the alternative sum of points minus lines plus triangles of the discrete surface, which is the genus, the general character of the discretized surface.
Great, thanks very much.
Okay, so let's go to slide number 8. Now, in slide number 8, what I'm presenting, because what follows is somewhat technical from point to point, I just try to exhibit how the concepts which we've seen in two dimensions generate in higher dimensions. And I do this in this, fast on this slide and then in detail later. So first of all, we've seen that the surfaces, they are in one-to-one correspondence with the ribbon graph, which are generated by partition function given by an action S. Now, what was phi before, the matrix phi, we now call M. So this action has some scaling with capital N in front times a quadratic part connecting ribbon lines plus an interaction part which generates the ribbon vertices. Now, as I said, this ribbon graph, they have an associative number, the genus, which is a positive number, and this genus encodes the 1 over n expansion because the amplitude of a ribbon graph is n to the power 2 minus 2g. And last but not least, the genus 0 graph, they represent spheres. So each of these concepts generalizes straightforwardly in higher dimension in the following way. So in higher dimension, we will deal with more complicated graphs, so which are stranded graphs, instead of, because we try to represent higher dimensional simplices and not only triangles, we need to add extra structure in our vertices, so we need to draw more strands. So we deal with stranded graphs, and most importantly, with colored stranded graphs. This color constraint, as you will see, plays a crucial role in all of the sequels. So this 1 over n expansion works in the presence of the colors, but as far as I know, we have no control over what happens in the absence of colors. So these stranded graphs, they will represent gluing of, let's say, tetrahedra in 3 dimensions, or 4 simplices in 4 dimensions, and the higher dimensional simplices in higher dimensions, and they will lead to d-dimensional spaces. I will make a precise statement about these spaces later. Now, such graphs, Dibbon stranded graphs, will be generated by a tensor model given by an action which has some scaling with capital N, where capital N this time is the dimension of the tensor, so each of the indices, discrete indices of the tensor, sums between 1 and capital N. And this action will also have some interaction part, which will represent a simplex in the appropriate number of dimensions, and some quadratic part, which will represent gluing. So I will be able to generate the class of graph I'm talking about by an action, and for each colored stranded graph, I will define for you a number, which I will call the degree of the graph, which will be again a positive number. Now the important thing about this this degree is that it will also encode the one over n expansion, namely I will show to you that the amplitude of a graph rises the capital N to some power which decreases with the degree. So you see that this expression here shows that the graphs of degree zero are the leading order graphs, and then graphs of higher degree, they are more and more suppressed in power of 1 over n. This is the crux of the 1 over n expansion in arbitrary dimensions.
So sorry, may I ask you?
Yes.
So the n here, it refers to the number of colors?
No. The number of colors is p plus 1. So you can see on the interaction part, there I wrote p0, p1, up to d, so these are the colors. They are called 0, 1, 2, 3, up to the dimension d.
Oh, okay.
N is the exactly the matrix model is the range of the different indices. So it is exactly the same large N parameter one would expect for tensor model. And at the end of this talk, well, in the second part, let's say, I will try to explain to you that the leading order graphs, those of degree zero, are spheres. So without further ado, let's go and discuss this more colored tensor model. So let's go to slide number 9. What I'll be doing, I'll be studying the theory which has in every dimension two classes of vertices which I'll be calling clockwise and anticlockwise turning vertices. They represent positive and negative oriented d simply. For instance, if you look at the drawing on the top left corner, I have a four-bar and vertex which will represent a tetrahedron. So the half lines of this vertex represent the triangles bound in the tetrahedron. And the crucial ingredient is that I'll give them a color. So I will distinguish the triangles which bound my tetrahedron. The red triangle will be called zero, and this will be represented by a half line of color zero in my vertex. And the blue triangle behind will be called one, and it will be represented by a half line of color one in my vertex, and so on and so forth for the other one. Of course, this also can be generalized in higher dimensions. It's just that it becomes more complicated. So the vertex represents, for instance, a four simplex in four dimensions, and the half lines represent the tetrahedra bound in the four simplex. Now, what's important is that my lines, what they will be doing, they will be connecting vertices which turn in the opposite way, so they will always connect a clockwise and an anticlockwise turning vertex. That means I will always glue a positive and a negative tetrahedron or simplex in higher dimensions, respecting the colorings. So my lines will have an associated color, and they will always have parallel strands. So I only allow the gluings in which the strands are parallel in the lines, and you can see that for the line I drew for the three-dimensional case, the vertex on the right turns clockwise, and the vertex on the left turns anticlockwise. So why is this important to only connect respecting the colors and with parallel strands? Because, in fact, this allows us to identify very efficiently the strands in my graph. If you look on the top of the vertex, which corresponds to a tetrahedron, you see that the strands common to the half line 0 and 1, which I drew in, indigo there. So it's a strand 0, 1. What does it correspond to? It must correspond to something which is common to the triangle 0 and 1. And if I will look at the tetrahedron, what's common to the triangle 0 and 1 is an edge 0, 1. So what is important is that because I only allow these gluings respecting the colorings and with parallel strands, the edge which is called 0, 1 for the tetrahedron on the right for the drawings of the line is the same one as the edge 0, 1 which is called 0, 1 from the tetrahedron on the left. So the edges, they conserve the labels. So not only that my triangles are well labeled by a color, but my edges are also well labeled by a color. So in particular, this means that the strands in my graph will be always identified by a couple of colors, and they will correspond to d-2 dimensional simplices. So in three dimensions, they correspond to one simplice, that is to edges. In higher dimensions, they will correspond, for instance, to a triangle in four dimensions, and so on and so forth. So these are the rules to build my graph. And what I'll be doing right now, I'll write for you the action which generates them. So let's go to slide number 10. So the action, well, because I distinguished my triangles, let's say in three dimensions, I need to have several pairs of fields. So I will need a field for each color. As in three dimensions, I have four valent vertices, I need four colors. So I will have, in three dimensions, I will have four fields. called T0, T1, T2, and T3. And, well, because I have positive and negative vertices, I need actually a pair for each color, so I get a T and a T bar. And what I'll be doing, look at this action I wrote. I have in front a scaling in capital N, and then I have two vertices, one with lambda, one with lambda bar. Each of these vertices represents the connectivity of a stranded vertex, which I showed you on the previous transparency. So, okay, it's a bit of a pain, but one can check that actually the indices as I wrote them exactly reproduce the connectivity of the strands. And you see that it involves a product over all the colors. So these vertices, they involve all the colors, 0, 1, 2, 3, and so on and so forth. So I have two of them because I have a positive and a negative vertex. So I have the vertex with T's and the vertex with T bars. Now, the quadratic part will only connect T and T bars. So it will only connect positive and negative vertices. It will only glue simplices of opposite orientation. So once I know this action, what I'll be doing is the following. I will generate all possible graphs, Feynman graphs with this action. So I will necessarily need to address at some point the question of the topology. What is the topology of these graphs generated by this action? And second, I will try to compute the amplitude of this graph. And in order to compute the amplitude, let's first note that because I only connect positive and negative vertices, any vacuum graph, I'll be dealing only with vacuum graphs in this talk, will have an even number of vertices. So for every graph of this theory, the number of vertices curly N will in fact be too small p, and where p is, let's say, the number of positive vertices, which equals the number of negative vertices of my graph. Now, because of the scaling in front of the action, each of these vertices will bring an N to the power d by 2 in the amplitude. Now, the lines of the graph, like in matrix models, each of them will bring an N to the power minus d by 2 in the amplitude. And finally, how about the faces of a graph? Exactly like in matrix models, they can be represented by Kronecker deltas, which compose along faces, and each face will bring a large N factor. So all in all, the amplitude of a graph will have some coupling constants in front. P of them are positive, P of them are lambdas, P of them are lambda bars. And then the scaling in capital N will be what? Minus the number of lines times d by 2, plus the number of vertices times d by 2, plus the number of faces. Now, before proceeding, I will just rearrange a bit this relation. Recall that my vertices, they are d plus 1 valent in d dimensions. For instance, in 3 dimensions, they are 4 valent. In 4 dimensions, they are 5 valent, and so on and so forth. So the number of vertices times d plus 1 equals twice the number of lines. So the lines are built by joining the vertices like this. So this gives me an evaluation of the number of lines of a graph in terms of the small p, which is the half number of vertices, namely the number of lines is d plus 1 times small p. So substituting this above gives me an expression where the amplitude is entirely given by p, the half number of vertices, times a certain factor, plus the number of faces. So in order to understand the 1 over n expansion of this model, I will need to compute in some way the number of faces. Now, because the topology is a bit involved, I'll be starting actually by computing a number of faces and show you the 1 over n expansion, and then I will discuss the topology of the graph and the fact that the leading order graphs are here. So let's go to slide number 11.
No, wait a second. So I'm confused about the notation here. So if you look at your slide 8, you had written down an action there.
Yes.
And that action had no lambda bar at all.
Yeah, it didn't have a lambda bar because I didn't have enough space to write it there. So I'm sorry for this. It's just a fast notation. It's, on slide 8, it's just meant to show that I can generate this graph by an explicit action. Slide 10 is the one which gives the precise form of the action.
Okay, so slide 10 is precisely the same action written. I mean, the
correct action. So if you want, slide 8 is just an announcement. Look, I'll be able to write an action for you. Slide 10 actually does it by writing.
I'm still confused about, so T and T bar are two different species of tensor fields, they're complex conjugates, or what is bar?
No, there are two different species of tensor fields if you want.
Okay.
So T bar is not the complex conjugate of T.
Right. It's
a partner of T.
So there are two coupling constants, lambda and lambda bar.
There are two coupling constants, lambda and lambda bar, and what should not, lambda bar is not necessarily the complex conjugate of lambda.
Good, thank you.
Okay. Okay, so let's go to slide number 11.
Should I press this button?
It's on.
Yeah, okay. So, in general, this action is not real, or what?
So, unless you say that T bar is the complex conjugate of T, then the action is not real, yes.
Okay, I've said it's not the complex conjugate.
So, you can very well consider it to be the complex conjugate if you want. You have no need of doing that. So you can consider it a different field, T and T bar, and
But the number of degrees of freedom must be different then.
Yes, but the graphs are not. So so what happens is that if T bar is the complex conjugate or not of T, what will change is the combinatorial factor of your graph. But the graphs themselves will appear, all the graphs will be there again, and amplitude will be the same. It's rather the combinatorial factors are different if T bar is the complex conjugate of T or not. If you like, consider T bar to be the complex conjugate of T, it's not a problem. Anyway, it's an independent variable from T. T and T bar are independent.
Okay,
is that satisfactory? Okay, so let's go to slide number 11 now. So the point is the following, is that once you've represented this transit graph, which they represent gluings of simplices in higher dimensions, well, they are a bit complicated. So they have all these internal structures, they have the faces are much more non-trivial, they are identified by a couple of colors, but they are, you know, in a big graph, you know, potentially there are many, many faces, and it's difficult to understand and to analyze. So this is the important point of the 1 over n expansion. In order to understand how these graphs, what the amplitude of these graphs and so on, one needs to find find some simpler graphs on which to start its analysis. So how could one define some simpler graphs? Well, for instance, if you look at the vertex represented here, you know, 0, 1, 2, 3 in the upper left corner of the transparency, you see that I have a lot of strands, but if I forget the strands 0, 2, and 1, 3, which are middle strands, I recover a simpler vertex, which is just the vertex made by the solid strand in the drawing. So because my line only connects parallel strands, the strand 0, 2, which goes through a middle of a line, will always be in the middle of line. So by deleting the strand 0, 2, effectively I delete the internal structure, the interior, on all on some lines in my graph. If I do the same with 1, 3, I delete the interior structure for other lines, and all in all, deleting the 0, 2, and the 1, 3 strands, in fact, completely erases the internal structure of my graph. So what I'll be getting a simpler graph, which has four valent vertices, but it's only a ribbon graph. So it has vertices, it has lines, it only has a subclass of the faces of the initial graph, and it's most importantly a ribbon graph, hence it's easy to analyze. Now, the point is that, okay, these strands 0, 2, and 1, 3, what's so special about them? Why are they the strands which, you know, which allow me to simplify my graph, and the other couples don't? Well, in fact, they are not the only couples which allow me to simplify my graph for the following reason. If we think of the dual picture represented by the tetrahedron under the vertex, 0, 2 is the strand which is common to the red triangle 0 and the green triangle 2. So it's the red-green edge. That is the edge 0, 2. Now, 1, 3 is the edge which is common to the blue triangle and to the brown triangle. So that is the edge behind, you know, the blue-brown edge. So what's special about 0, 2, and 1? See, the only thing which is special is that there are a couple of edges on the tetrahedron which don't touch each other. They are opposite edges on the tetrahedron. But they are not the unique possible choice of opposite edges on the tetrahedron. Indeed, I can choose 0, 1, which is the edge common to the red and blue in the drawing, and 2, 3, which is the edge common to the green and brown in the drawing. So these 2, 0, 1, and 2, 3 are a perfectly equivalent couple of edges which are opposite on the tetrahedron. And I have a third choice, namely the edges 1, 2, and 0, 3. So this leads us to understand that, in fact, there are several ribbon graphs I can associate to a graph, to a stranded graph. Namely, there are three of them in three dimensions, and for the simplest possible graph in three dimensions consisting of two vertices but completely identified, they are represented here, you know. So the first drawing, you see it's a ribbon graph, which has all the lines of the initial graph, all the vertices, but it only has the faces 0, 1, 1, 2, 2, 3, and 3, 0. Now, the second drawing is again a ribbon graph. Now, it might appear a bit weird because the ribbon vertices seem twisted, but this is just an illusion. In fact, if I permute, let's see the lines 1 and 2 in the second drawing, I straighten all the vertices, and in fact, I can do this for an arbitrary graph. So I can straighten all these twisted vertices, and I get an honest ribbon graph. So this second graph contains the faces 0, 2, 2, 1, 1, 3, and 3, 0. The third graph contains the faces 0, 1, 1, 3, 3, 2, and 2, 0. Now, okay, I understood how I can associate these three Riemann graphs for a graph in three dimensions. Can I generalize this concept in arbitrary dimension? And indeed, it can be done. And in the following way, what I'll be doing, I'll be taking a graph in arbitrary dimensions and I will be erasing the interior strand. So erasing the interior strand will give me a Riemann graph all the time. And what's special about this graph is like I'm sitting on zero, let's say, on the half-line zero, and I'm going to visit the half-line one. And then from the half-line one, I'm going to visit the half-line two, and so on and so forth. So this is the Riemann vertex I get by deleting the interior structure. But if you look at the tetrahedron drawn there, if I am on my triangle zero, how do I know which one of the triangles is called one? So of course it's a choice that I put the blue triangle to be on, but it could have very well been the green triangle one. So in fact, from the point of view of my triangle zero, it's perfectly equivalent to go to the triangle one or to go to the triangle two or to go to the triangle three first. So in fact, I get perfectly equivalent graphs. Instead of just looking at the cycle 0, 1, 1, 2, 2, 3, and so on and so forth, which returns to 0, by looking at a different cycle, 0 goes in pi of 0, which goes in pi square of 0, and so on and so forth. Now, obviously, for an anterior cycle like this, I'll get maybe a twisted vertex, but this is not a problem. I can always straighten it in my graph by just simple graphical manipulations. And, well, the only condition is that this pi must be a cycle, so it must start from 0 and end up with 0, you know, because my initial drawing was starting from 0 and going 0, 1, 1, 2, and so on and so forth, and the last phase was D0. Now, how many independent distinct graphs like this do I get? So if I count the number of cycles over, we start from 0 and end with 0 over these colors, I get D factorial of them. But note that if I go on a cycle 0, 1, 2, 3 up to D, or if I go on the cycle 0, D, D minus 1 up to 1, in fact I get the same Riemann graph just flipped on the vertical. So only half of these cycles are independent, so I get 1 over 2 D factorial distinct jackets, which are Riemann graphs in arbitrary dimensions associated to my graph. Now these jackets, they contain all the vertices and all the lines of G, and a given phase belongs to D minus 1 factorial jackets, so why is this? Imagine the phase 0, 1. So if I'm looking at all the cycles which start with 0 and end up with 0 and start with 0, 1, I get D minus 1 factorial of them. I get D minus 1 factorial which end in 1, so which go 1, 0. So I get 2 times D minus 1 factorial cycles, but I need to divide by 2 because I overcounted this flip symmetry I was talking about. So in fact, a given phase will belong only to D minus 1 factorial independent jacket. Now, these factors, they are important in the next slide. Before going to this, let me just define you for you the number I promised, the degree, so the degree of a graph. Well, because every jacket is a Riemann graph, it has an associated genus which I can compute graphically starting from my graph, and if I sum over all jackets this genus, I get a number which is a positive number being a sum of geni, which I call the degree of a graph. Now let's go to slide 12. What happens is that here we understand why we needed this notion of jackets. In fact, this degree gives me a counting of the number of faces of a graph. So before explaining exactly the proof of this theorem, are there any questions?
Could you be a bit more precise about how you want to do the
flip vertex? So you see that on a given vertex, a specific permutation of the half lines will undo the twist around this vertex. If you do this permutation on all the vertices at the same time in your graph, you undo all the flips on all the lines.
Can you restrict
that on the case? So can I go back to slide 11? So imagine that, here in order to undo, I have a jacket which is associated to a pi, yes? In order to undo the flips on a given vertex, I need to exactly permute my half lines as dictated by pi. So the next, after 0, instead of having the half line 1, I need to put the half line pi of 0. And the next one needs to be pi square of 0, and so on and so forth. This straightens my drawing on this vertex. But because I have the same pi on all vertices, it's the same permutation will undo all the twists in all my graphs. Is it clear? So let's go to slide 12. So So in order to understand how the counting of the faces of the graph is included in the degree, we need to recall the following. So I said that a jacket graph contains all the vertices of my initial graph, and namely there are 2p of them. Now the number of lines, as you've seen before, it was d plus 1 times p. So for every jacket j, which is a ribbon graph, the number of faces can be computed in terms of its genus. This is just a ribbon graph. We will give a number of lines and give a number of vertices. So namely, this is given by the relation 2p, which is the number of vertices, minus d plus 1 times p, which is the number of lines, plus the number of faces of the jacket, equals 2 minus twice the genus of the jacket. So if I just add up this counting of the faces of a jacket over all my jackets, I get an overcount of the number of faces of a graph. So d minus 1 factorial times the number of faces equals the sum of this object for all the jackets. Dividing by d minus 1 factorial, I established that the number of faces of a graph equals some corrective factor minus the factor times the degree. Now why is this important? If you recall, we computed the amplitude of a graph several transparencies ago, and we seen that it was equal to the large n to the power minus p times the factor plus the number of faces, and if I just substitute this counting of the number of faces in the formula, I see that in fact the small p factor completely cancels, and what I get in the amplitude, in the scaling of the amplitude, is just large n to the power of the dimension minus 2 by d minus 1 factorial times the degree of a graph. So this is the promised formula. This is the 1 over n expansion of the graph in tensor model, and I see that higher degree graphs are suppressed. The degree being the sum of g naught is a positive number, and the leading order graphs are given by graphs of degree 0. So are there any questions about the 1 over n expansion so far? Okay. Because now we are going to slide 13, and we'll devote the next several slides to understanding why the graph of degree 0, which dominates this 1 over n expansion, represents fear. So first of all, let's understand a bit better the structure of this colored graph. First, we have a theorem by Ferri and Gagliardi, which ensures us that any d-dimensional piecewise linear orientable manifold admits a colored triangulation. Meaning, if I generate all the possible graphs with my action, in fact, I will certainly generate all the manifolds. So I'm very happy about that. And before proceeding, let's recall a bit how these graphs are built. So we have some rules, vertices turn clockwise and anti-clockwise, the line connects on opposite vertex, conserving the color indices, and so on and so forth. Well, these rules, which I included at the level of the action, allow me to give a simplified representation of the graph by simply collapsing all the strands. So if you look at the graph on the left, you know, with all these strands drawn inside, I can certainly collapse everything. The lines become just simple lines, the vertices just simple vertices, but I keep track of the color information. So I can give a simplified representation of this stranded graph as a graph with simple vertices and lines which have a color, 0, 1, 2, and 3 in this particular case. Now what is important about the colors is that in fact I can also go the reverse from a simplified representation with colors to a graph with strands. And how do I do this? Well, I just expand every simple vertex in a stranded vertex and every simple line in a stranded line with parallel strands. Now, okay, the example I gave here, it's an example with four colors, so it represents a three-dimensional graph, but the same holds in arbitrary dimensions. So imagine that I just have a higher balance on my vertices, I can collapse them to vertices having more half lines of more colors, and the lines have a color. So in any dimension, I can encode all the information about my graph in this simplified graph with colors. Now, for the next slide, it would be maybe easier to think of my graph is this simplified representation with lines and the colors on the line. So let's go to slide 14. In fact, thinking of the simplified representation, I can see the vertices of a graph. Well, it's a bit of a weird way to look at these vertices, but still I can do it. I can see them as subgraphs with zero colors. So because the colors sit on my line, by cutting all the lines, so I eliminate all the colors from the picture, I just get my vertices. So the vertices of a graph are subgraphs with zero colors. Now, by definition, the lines are the subgraph with exactly one color. And as I explained to you, the faces of the closed strands are the subgraph with exactly two colors. So obviously, this almost imposes itself to be generalized for a larger number of colors. So what I have is, I define an object which is called the bubble, the N bubble, as the maximally connected subgraph with N fixed colors. For instance, if you look at the drawing in the second line, I start from the simplified representation of my graph, you know, collapsed. And in order to build the three bubbles, so they are the subgraphs with three colors, I just delete, for, let's say, the line of color 1, so I obtain the first graph, or the line of color 2, I obtain the second graph, or the line of color 0, I obtain the third graph, or the line of color 3 to obtain the fourth graph. So in this simplified representation, it is very straightforward to obtain this drawing. Now, you recall that, you know, if you look at one of these bubbles, let's say the first one is color 0, 2, and 3, so this is just an honest graph with lines and colors, so it can be re-expanded in strands. I said that in arbitrary dimensions, I can represent graphs with strands or graphs with colors, and they are one-to-one correspondent. So this simplified graph, they can be re-expanded, and they give me some ribbon graphs in three dimensions, or in higher dimensions, one should imagine that, okay, I get this collapsed representation of the bubbles, which I can re-expand if I want, and I get some very complicated higher-dimensional tensor graph. Now, what happens is that these bubbles, they encode something about my the topology of my graph. Namely, a color graph is dual to an oriented three-dimensional manifold, pseudo-manifold, and its bubbles are dual to the links of the simplices of the pseudo-manifold. Now, this might seem a bit abstract. First of all, okay, you probably know what a pseudo-manifold is, so it's like a manifold but with some singularities. What happens is that if you see these bubbles, they are in some way associated to the simplices in my grouping of simplices. So for instance, in three dimensions, if you look of these bubbles with three colors, they are associated to the 3 minus 3, that means zero simplices of the grouping of tetrahedra. So in three dimensions, the bubbles with three colors, they are associated to the points in my grouping of tetrahedra. And in fact, in higher dimensions, the bubbles which have all colors except one are always associated to the vertices of my grouping of simplices. So they are, you know, they encode something about the topology of my space. Now these bubbles which have all colors but one and are associated to the vertices of the grouping, they are of some importance in the sequence. So let's go to the slide 15. Now I know it's becoming a bit complicated, but because we are doing topology, one should also understand a bit how do homomorphisms appear in this language. So you might be familiar, you know, with the fact that in usual tensor graphs like this, in graphs drawn with stranded vertices and stranded lines, one can encode homomorphism via what is called the partner move, the 1-4 move or the 2-3 move, and so on and so forth. Now, these graphical moves on the graphs, they don't go very well with color, so I can't really use this partner move in order to encode homomorphism in the color graph. However, there is a different class of moves which also involves homomorphism. And this is represented by what's called the one-dipole move. So first of all, what is the one-dipole? One-dipole is a line, say it's a line of color 0, which connects two vertices, B and W, so you see represented on the drawing, such that the bubbles containing all the colors 1 to D on the left and on the right are different. So how do I actually see this? I just take a graph, take a line 0 in it, you know, consider the vertex B, and I complete the maximally connected component which contains all the colors 1, 2, 3, 4, up to D. So I do this for V and I do this for W. If these two connected components are different, then this line is called a dipole. So what's important is that a dipole can be contracted, so it's a graphical operation I can perform for my graph. So I can delete the line 0, I can delete the vertices V and W, and I can reconnect the other lines respecting the color. So this is an operation I can always perform on my graph, you know, and I will call the graph after contraction, the G divided by D, the graph contracted by the dipole D. Now, what's important about this dipole is that, in fact, due to a theorem by the same Ferri and Gagliardi, if either of the two bubbles is dual to a sphere, then the two pseudo-manifolds dual to the graph G and the graph reduced are homomorphic. Now, this shows us that this one dipole, once they encode the homomorphism, the trick is that obviously it is extremely difficult to check if a bubble is a sphere or not. So in high dimensions, one must imagine that this bubble, this connected component with D colors, it's a large graph, it has many colors, so it's very difficult to state if it's a sphere or not. However, what I will be showing to you is that if the degree of a graph is zero, then it is a sphere. So whereas it is very difficult to see in general if a graph is a sphere or not, the degree of a graph being zero is a sufficient condition to ensure that a graph is a sphere. So let's go to transparency, to slide number 16. So on slide number 16, you know, things are getting even more complicated. What happens is that, a graph has a degree. It has bubbles. The bubbles are colored graphs themselves. So they also emit jackets and they also have a degree. And the degree of a graph and the degree of its bubbles, so these are the bubbles which have one less color than the graph, so which are associated in some sense to the vertices of the grouping of simplicity, if you want. So they are related by this combinatorial relation that I will not spend time to prove. So just accept that the degree of a graph, right, is this sum over the bubbles of the degree of the bubbles plus some correcting factor. Now, a second fact we need is that the degree of a graph is invariant under one dipole move. So with these two things in mind, let's go to the slide number 17 and show that the degree zero graphs are spheres. So first, I just recall here the relation between the degree of a graph and the degree of its bubbles. And what I'll be doing, I'll be taking a graph. It has two p vertices. And I will denote the number of v bubbles, so the bubbles having one less color, by v superscript v. And what I'll be doing, I'll be contracting a full set of one dipole. So I just contract, you know, I test line by line. If it's a one dipole, I contract. Now, in the end, doing this full contraction, I'll end up with some graph, which I call GF, which will have, which will be again a colored graph. It will have two PF vertices. And what happens is that it has something very special. It has exactly one bubble for each missing color. So why is that? Imagine that I would have two, let's say, which both of them miss the color zero. Because the graph is connected, they must be connected by some line of color zero. Hence, this line would be a dipole and it would be reduced. So what happens is that in the end, I will end up having exactly one bubble for each missing color. Now, under the contraction, you see that the number of vertices of my graph being decreased by 2, because in a contraction, I deleted both vertices. So the half number of vertices, p, decreases by 1. Also, the number of the bubbles decreases by 1, because initially, the condition to be able to reduce a dipole was that the two bubbles were different, and after I contracted the dipole, they've been merged into an unique d-bubble. So under a contraction, p decreases by 1 and the number of d bubbles decreases by 1. And taking into account the fact that the final number of d bubbles is d plus 1, I get some relation which relates a certain sum of the initial data, p plus the dimension minus the number of d bubbles, with the final number of vertices. Pf is, if you want, it's half the final number of vertices. Now, if you see this factor here, p plus d minus the dimension of the d bubbles, being equal with Pf minus 1, and Pf is at least 1 because the final graph exists, is necessarily a positive number. So if I look at the counting of the graph as a function of the degree of the graph as a function of the degree of the bubbles, I see that the first corrective factor is actually necessarily positive. Hence, if the degree of a graph is 0, the degree of all its bubbles is necessarily 0. Then with this in mind, we can actually prove that if the graph has degree 0, then it's dual to a sphere. So how does this work? Well, it works by induction. In two dimensions, the color graphs are just simple ribbon graphs. The degree is the genus. And in higher dimension, well, because the degree of a graph is zero, the degree of all its bubbles is zero. By induction, the bubbles are spheres. Hence, the contractions I performed, not only they preserve the degree of my graph, but they also represented homeomorphisms. So my final graph GF is necessarily homeomorphic with the initial graph G. And because the degree of a graph is zero, it implies that the PF, the half number of vertices, is 1. Hence, the final graph is necessarily a graph made with exactly two vertices, two colored vertices of opposite orientation, identified by all the lines. So it just represents the grouping of two simplices, the coherent grouping of the simplices along their boundary, so it's necessarily a sphere. So it follows that the initial graph was necessarily a sphere. So let's go to the slide 18 and to recapitulate what we've seen. So what we've seen is that if I generalize the matrix model in higher dimension to color sensor models, which can be generated by an action, which is recalled here in the appropriate form, I can define a number, which is the degree of the graph. It's a positive number. This number encodes the 1 over n expansion, so the amplitude of the graph are computed and suppressed in this degree. The colored graphs I generate always represent the dimensional pseudo-manifolds, and the leading order graphs, the graphs of degree 0, are spheres. So this is the strict generalization of the 1 over n expansion for matrix models in higher dimensions. So to go to the conclusions, slide 19. Okay, once we have this 1 over n expansion, what needs to be done in the future? So because so much of what's been done with matrix models relies on the 1 over n expansion, of course the hope would be to try to generalize as much as possible of the two-dimensional results in higher dimensions, exploiting this 1 over n expansion. So a list of first questions one could ask is, For instance, if the dominant sector is summable, in these formative models, the planar graphs form the summable sectors. So the same question can be asked, are the degree zero graphs summable? Second, does this dominant sector lead to a phase transition in the continuum theory? Indeed, it was the case in formative models, the planar graphs, they are a sum of family with finite radius of convergence. So tuning my sampling constant to the critical constant, I pick up some critical behavior and I pick up a phase transition to a continuum theory. So that's the same happen in higher dimension. If there is a phase transition, what are the critical exponents? Does it represent an universality class and so on and so forth? Here one consider more complicated models which lead to multi-critical points, as it is indeed the case in two dimensions, and so on and so forth. So that's the one for an expansion in higher dimensions.
Questions, comments?
Yes, I have a question.
Yes.
So in the large N expansion, you to leading order, you generate manifolds.
They are sphere. Not only they are manifolds, in high dimensions, they are necessarily sphere.
Yeah. Well, I've said that. But, but now, in a large N expansion, then you are still summing over pseudo-manifolds.
So, you have this one over an expansion. If you restrict to only the leading graph, let's say, you will sum over only over the sphere. Of course, if you consider the entire series, you will sum over everybody. It's just that the subsequent terms are suppressed. So already manifolds, but which don't have a spherical topology, are suppressed. Then you have pseudo manifolds, they are also suppressed, and so on and so forth. But as in matrix models, when you consider the entire series, you will need to deal with graphs of arbitrary genus. Here also, you will need to deal with graphs of arbitrary degree, which can have absolutely, you know, they can be pseudo manifolds, they can be more complicated manifolds, and so on.
Okay, there's a question here.
So is there a way to generalize this to non-colored tensor models, or is that just much more complicated?
So there are several issues about the non-colored tensor models. First of all, you see that crucial for this was the notion of jackets. So already it was a bit complicated to explain, and there are all these ideas about how you undo the twist and so on and so forth. The thing is that in the presence of the current, you can actually define these jackets. We can actually talk about specific ribbon subgraphs which are hidden inside your D-graphs and allow you to access its power counting. This is one of the notions which relies crucially on the colors. You've seen that they are defined starting from permutations of colors and so on and so forth. And it is not at all obvious that it's possible to find some sort of generalization of this in the absence of colors. Because, you see, it's not clear that you don't have the same face which returns several times on the strands on a line or some or things like this. You know, you can even return, you know, in three dimensions because the lines have three strands. They can actually, all of them belong to the same face a priori. So, it's not clear if the jacket is generalized appropriately in higher dimensions. Generalized appropriately for non-colored models. Second, these dipole moves, I don't know exactly how they could be generalized for non-colored models. So in short, I don't believe that much of this can be generalized in the absence of color.
Okay, I have a bunch of questions, so let me just ask. These are kind of not so technical questions. They are about conceptually how close this is to quantum gravity and how far it is from quantum gravity.
Yes.
So normally in quantum gravity or something, one would think that the scale or at which some classicality would emerge, manifold structure would emerge, would have something to do with Planck's constant. And in this model, I don't see anything about Planck's constants at all. Is there some way to identify?
So the classicality would emerge like in two dimensions in the continuum limit. So if these models, they did undergo a phase transition towards the continuum theory, it is in this continuum theory that one would expect to find something which looks like gravity and so on and so forth. So what happens in two dimensions? Well, probably Jan is actually better knows better than me how to answer these questions. As far as I know, in the continuum limit one, we cover, for instance, reveal gravity to different matter contents, and so on and so forth. This is what we want to look for practicality. Is there any Planck constant in this practicality? A priori, it should be, let's say, in a continuum limit. It might survive in some senses, the small parameter which describes the volume of a tetrahedron.
Planck units are very tricky because G and H bar is dimensionless. So G and H bar have the kind of one upon each other's dimensions.
Yes. So I agree that morally, in two dimensions, it's actually much more natural to recover gravity in this continuum limit. And here in higher dimensions, we don't yet see a Planck's constant, so we don't yet know exactly what kind of continuum theory we will find or if we have anything to do with gravity. I think that answers the comment.
Yeah, I can add to this. So actually, in the tensor models, in plays exactly the same role as in two dimensions, that it is formally associated with the gravitation coupling constant. So this is probably also the case here. So what happens precisely in two dimensions is, of course, that to talk meaningful about the Planck constant, you have to sum over genus, because that's the only point where it occurs. And then you see that when you take the continuum limit, it's a combination of n and the coupling constant which enter there, which will play exactly the role of Planck constant. And well, if one can take such a continuum limit here, I would expect the same phenomena to emerge here. So the Planck constant, which will now have dimensions, well, you have then to introduce, you have to go back and go to the critical point, introduce a lattice scale unit, which puts in dimension in the theory, and in the end, you will expect some combination of this lambda and n, and the lattice spacing A to occur as the bare gravitational.
So this is in what is called the double scaling.
It's called the double scaling limit, but you would expect something similar here.
If you just
take the most naive tensor model without colors, as we did many, many years ago, formally you see that G, the Einstein gravitation coupling constant, is just 1 over n. So that's just how it comes out. So I would expect the same here. So there's nothing really mysterious, but the...
But n is dimensionless, g has dimensions. I don't see how g can be. I mean, you might be putting it by hand by saying something happens near the critical point.
Look, in any lattice theory, of course, what you have is bare numbers. I mean, anything is dimensionless, and you have to put in an explicit cutoff to kind of relate to dimensionful quantities.
But why is this a lattice theory? I don't see this as a lattice theory, right? This is just a theory which is written down, which is a background independent theory. There's no lattice in this theory as far as I can see.
You have to do exactly the same in two dimensions. I mean, you have to say that each triangle, and in this case each tetrahedra or whatever, is really a building block with a lattice length A. And this is how you introduce a length scale in the theory. Of course, in the end, you want to trade this length scale with a continuum coupling constant like G. And that's what you can do in two dimensions. And I expect, as I said, I expect that if there is a critical point in this model, if it should go to a continuum model, you should be able to do the same thing.
Okay. So what I can certainly state is that it cannot work any other way than in two dimensions. So if it works like this in two dimensions, this is how it has to work here also.
Okay, but the second thing is that from the beginning, are you sticking yourself to compact manifolds, or what's the...
For now, I just consider closed graphs, so which represent closed manifolds. And if I look at a given order, they are built out of n, building blocks. So they are, if you want, closed connected manifolds.
But so, for example, if I were doing cosmology, very often k equal to 0, which is observed cosmology, is put on a torus cross real line. T3 cross R. So spatial topology is, for example, torus, not... So this would not be compatible, or this would just be outside the scope of this kind of investigation?
I don't have a good answer to this. I can just give you a scenario. The scenario for me would be the following. You will take, you would instead of just looking at vacuum graphs, if you want, so instead of just looking at closed manifolds, you put some boundaries, and you look at the manifolds with boundaries, and then you try to identify some kind of in and out state, which would be asymptotics of these boundaries. So a priori, one should be able to treat open manifolds also by introducing some kind of in and out geometry state, if you want.
Okay.
But as far as things which are controlled up till now are for closed manifolds, so for now is not really directly applicable to cosmology, I agree.
So, some while ago, there was some disagreement between Matthew and your work about pseudo-manifolds and so on, which was very difficult for non-experts to understand. Has that something been sorted out? Is Matthew also online here? Or?
I don't know if he's online. So we actually had a talk about this at there was a recent conference in our state. And as far as my take on the result of the conference is that we agreed that it's a matter of starting point. And if you start from a strictly combinatorial perspective, then I am right. If you add extra ingredients, then you can do the procedure he suggests. So it's not really a very profound discussion, if you want. It's more of a matter of a starting point. If you are very baroque and you strictly give you just a set of three rules, and this you say, okay, I just think the rules are strictly encoded in the combinatorics of this theory, then you get something. But if you allow yourself to put extra rules in, which cannot be encoded at the level of the action, then you can build this pseudo-manifold. So as far as I'm concerned, this is solved in a small point which has been clarified. So.
Okay. That helps us.
Yeah.
Any other questions or comments?
I have one more question. So now let's assume that everything is fine. Have you looked at the large N limit? I mean, have you tried to derive some, if you take the analogy with two dimensions, some eigenvalue equations which can be solved? Because
the loop equations?
Yeah.
So the loop equations are an open topic, and it's in the back of my mind. So it's work in progress. But it's definitely one of the next steps. So the first step is to see if there is a phase transition, and this can be done even without loop equations, because it's just analyzing this dominant sector and see if it has a finite radius of convergence and so on and so forth could be done. Now, loop equations are the necessarily second step, and they are in the back of my mind, so I'm trying to think about them. Open subject.
Okay, I got one other question, which is maybe either Jan or you can both, or both of you can answer. So, I mean, you wrote down some action. But then, I mean, that action just depended on the number of indices the tensors had and so on. But then, after that, everything was done combinatorially. And
yes.
It seemed that the details, content of the tensor was not that important. I mean, in the matrix model, whether I'm taking matrices to be Hermitian or unitary, so similarly here I could take tensors, I can classify them, put them some symmetries, not put some symmetries, do anything I want. But the final results appear to be universal.
The only thing which you are not allowed to do is to start permuting the indices.
To start
permuting the indices. So you are not allowed to assume symmetry properties of your tensor from the point of view of the indices, because this would induce permutation on the strands, and this is what you don't want in this story. So just don't put any symmetry property for the tensor, but then, in fact, the one over an expression is very robust. So it doesn't really matter if the indices are integer numbers or if the index representations of SU2 or something different. Moreover, actually, the same kind of expansion works if instead of working with a simple identical distributed model with Kronecker delta for the quadratic part, you put more involved quadratic part, like the which reproduce, for instance, the Bulatov-Ogury group field theories, the same one over an expansion in the color case holds, and so on and so forth.
So, if you want,
as long as you don't put symmetries in your tensor, it's a pretty robust mechanism.
Okay, but so is it a statement that there is a universality class of models for which all results are exactly the same, or is a statement that only things like topology of the leading leading term in the one over n expansion is the same and so on. Is a claim that there is a universality class with these tensor models where you're not allowed to permit indices, but otherwise you can do whatever you want, has exactly the same physics, or only
yes,
some other
physics? The same is the following. For instance, if there is a phase transition, which we are about to actually kind of see there exists, so this is work in progress, but for instance, the critical exponent of this phase transition is completely independent on the details of the model, like what group, what kind of indices you have, so are they going from 1 to capital N, are they indexing representations of SU2 or whatever. There is the same critical exponent also if you take this model or the Bulatov-Ogury model and so on and so forth. So certainly there exists an universality class. And there are some predictions which are certainly completely oblivious to these details.
Last questions or comments?
Yeah, I have some of this. So, if I understand it correctly, you are in a way saying that you are generating all, in the leading n expansion, all spheres, say in 3 dimensions or 4 dimensions. So.
No, not all spheres.
Not all spheres.
Not all spheres. I generate graphs which have spherical topology, but there are graphs in spherical topology which have very, very high degree, if you want. So there are spherical topologies which are completely spheres but extremely suppressed. So it's just a subclass of the spheres, very special spheres, which contribute to the leading order. If you ask, they are the simplest of the spheres. So the spheres are the simplest manifolds, and among them, the simplest spheres contribute to the leading order.
Oh, I see. I see. So it's a somewhat, I wouldn't say weird, but subclass of spheres.
It's a subclass of spheres, yes.
Thank you. Because, well, else it would be very interesting because, you see, it's of course still a strictly unsolved combinatorial question, and actually the best mathematicians in combinatorics are very interested in this question, to count the number of say, 3 spheres, 4 spheres. So it is not even known whether it grows exponentially or not, or faster than exponential.
So certainly, that is one kind of very interesting question. Another very interesting question is,
but unfortunately, this will not answer it.
No, certainly not. But look, yeah. This degree, it's a poor number. I can compute it. It's easy to compute. It cannot be the magical number which solves open questions in topology. It's.
But this is not so much a topology question, but it's just a combinatorial question, which actually is also related to the conjecture.
Yes, certainly. Obviously, we would like to have a perfect characterization of here. This degree doesn't do it.
Yeah.
It's not a very effective way to get the leading behavior of the tensor model.
Okay. But the tensor model, now I'm confused because the tensor model itself, of course, includes all spheres.
Yes, and many other things.
And many more.
Yes.
But now it's the leading order, by that you mean the spheres.
Yes, so the leading orders are only spheres. So imagine that you have a matrix model.
But you are not getting this all the spheres.
No, not all the spheres, only some class of spheres.
Yeah. So in this way, you're not reproducing the leading order of the tensor model, I would say. You're producing something else.
So what I'm reproducing, is that in this analytic 1 over n expansion, the dominant order is a subclass of the sphere.
Yeah, okay, good. Thanks.
Just students and so on are getting confused here, which is, when you use a sphere in 2 different ways, one is topological and the other is sphere with a metric, right? So when you say you don't get all spheres, you don't get all spheres.
The spheres I'm talking about are topological spheres, are what is called PL spheres, piecewise linear spheres. In higher dimensions, these piecewise linear spheres, so in 3 dimensions, they are 1-to-1 with the spheres, if you want disk spheres. Smooth spheres, the smooth structures and the PL structures are 1-to-1. In higher dimensions, this is not the case. So when I'm talking spheres, I'm talking only from the strictly topological piecewise linear point of view.
Piecewise linear point. Okay, good. All right, so let's thank Razvan again.
Okay, thanks.
They have a recorded.